Hi, I'm Faith Mitchell, President and CEO of Grantmakers in Health. Welcome to the third annual Lauren LeRoy Health Policy Lecture given on November 20th, 2015. The lecture was given by Michael Botticelli, Director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. Director Botticelli joined ONDCP as Deputy Director in 2012 and was sworn in as Director in February 2015. The Office of National Drug Control Policy advises the President on substance use issues, coordinates activities and funding across the federal government, and produces the annual National Drug Control Strategy. Grantmakers in Health established the Lauren LeRoy Health Policy Lecture Series in honor of its former President and CEO, Lauren LeRoy, and her commitment to increasing communication between the worlds of philanthropy and policy. The series is supported by grants from Blue Shield of California Foundation, California Endowment, California Healthcare Foundation, California Wellness Foundation, Colorado Health Foundation, Kaiser Permanente, Missouri Foundation for Health, New York State Health Foundation, and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
Thanks to Grantmakers in Health for having me here today. I feel a kind of a special obligation that I'm actually giving a lecture named for someone who's still here. So not only do I feel it important to deliver to you, but also to really talk about kind of what I think is one of the most pressing health and health policy issues that we have in front of us right now, and that's issues around substance use issues. One of the things that I learned over my time, particularly in Massachusetts, doing HIV/AIDS work for a long time, is the value of people with lived experience at every point in the policymaking process. And I'm really thrilled to be at ONDCP and at the White House and to bring the consumer perspective to the work that we do. And I think you all know the importance of that. So Robin talked a little about what our office does. So we know that issues around drug policy and addiction have its impact and span all parts of government. So to that extent, our office coordinates drug control activities across federal government. And I think many of you probably work in states that have similar structures, right, where there's a governor's office. Where's Tim? So, you know, his job in New Hampshire is to do that at the state level. So we are emblematic of that. And we produce the National Drug Control Strategy. And part of what we have been moving toward is obviously a much more compassionate, humane, and public health-focused national drug control strategy that really treats issues around drug use as a public health priority. And clearly, public safety has a role to play, but this is fundamentally a public health issue. You know, one of the things that is actually nice about our office is we actually have budget authority over those agencies, which is helpful in terms of ensuring that federal funding is aligned with what our priorities are in a government. So if you look at our funding for what we call demand reduction, public health approaches, it's at its highest level since the establishment of our office in 1988. So we clearly have a ways to go. We acknowledge the role that reducing the supply has. And I think as many of you have been embedded in public health, have seen whether it's tobacco or food policy, kind of getting bad stuff out of our communities increases the probability that people are going to make healthy choices in their life. So we produced the strategy. We just actually released our 2015 strategy, a little late, but it's online if you care to look at it. And it really has a number of key principles. One, preventing drug use before it begins. Expanding access to treatment for Americans struggling with addiction. And I'll talk a little bit about where we are and the opportunities under the Affordable Care Act and talk a little bit about parity. But also reforming our criminal justice system is particularly important. We know that arresting and incarcerating our way out of this problem is not the solution. One of the things that really invigorates me is as I travel the country and I talk to local law enforcement, I hear that echoed back the entire time. And I'll talk a little bit about opportunities when we think about kind of public-private sector things that we can do. Those of us who have been in the public health world for a long time, and particularly in the edgier public health world, we didn't really want to tell police what we were doing. That has changed dramatically over the past few years. Talking to the police chief in Dayton, Ohio, who implemented this program called Conversations for Change. And what they're doing is they're providing an incentive for people who have experienced an overdose to come to a meeting police kind of leave the scene, and they have specialty trained peers in motivational interviewing and in trying to look at providing opportunities to get people into care and treatment. In Gloucester, Massachusetts, you know, the Gloucester police chief started this angel program where you can come in, you know, regardless of the drug charges, and they will find treatment for you and get you to care. So we really have an opportunity to do that. And last is supporting Americans in recovery. I always say, you know, I'm one of estimated 23 million people who are in recovery in the United States. And it's been really encouraging to see the tremendous increase in vibrancy and advocacy coming out of the recovery community. And many of us have wanted to see that for a very, very long time. I know many of you probably have been involved in HIV and AIDS-related work for a long time and saw the role that advocates and people affected had in terms of changing public policy and public practice. So we have a lot to learn from other diseases and other affected communities and how we change the issues that we have. This is our probably most succinct way to talk about from arrest and incarceration to really treatment and recovery. I will make a caveat to this, though. You know, one of the things that has been particularly disturbing, and some of you may have been listening to NPR has done a series this entire week looking at the recriminalization of pregnant women with an opiate addiction. And so we now have states, Tennessee, South Carolina, Alabama, other states are looking at legislation that put enhanced criminal penalties for women who are using substances. And I don't have to explain to this group kind of the problems that that. But while kind of the rest of the criminal justice reform movement seems to go forward as it relates to how we've historically treated pregnant women with addiction issues, we seem to be taking some steps backwards. So, you know, we could talk about opportunities for advocacy, particularly in those states. So I just want to talk a little bit about the opioid epidemic, and I want to put it in the framework that I think what the opioid epidemic has done is really kind of highlighted some longstanding issues around the field of substance use issues. And it really, I think, exacerbated and really contributed to the epidemic that we have in the United States. So here's data that probably all of you know, where you've seen the tremendous increase. The red line is overdoses, deaths through 2013 from opioid analgesics. Those overdose deaths correlate quite nicely, I hate to use that word, with the dramatic overprescribing of prescription pain medication in the United States. The CDC showed that in 2012, we are now prescribing enough pain medication in the United States to give every adult American their own bottle of pills. Now, clearly, we don't want people in pain to be suffering. We know that we've kind of swung the other way. And while that's been leveling off, we've seen the dramatic increase, 172%, in heroin overdoses. And I think you all know that 4/5 of newer users to heroin started misusing pain medication. So this emerging heroin epidemic is really born out of prescription drug misuse. So we know we have to focus on those related issues. And we also know that there's a dramatic variation in those rates by state. And interestingly enough, there is a pretty good correlation between state prescribing practices and state overdose rates. So we have about a threefold variation in prescribing at the state level. So Alabama or West Virginia, one of the most impacted states, I think is at the top of the range where it's close to 150 prescriptions per 100 people. So this is not even one for one. So we know that there's a direct correlation and variation at the state prescribing level. So in 2011, we produced a prescription drug abuse plan focusing on four areas. And one is education. And so why is education particularly important? So we know that those in the medical community get little to no training on substance use issues in general. You know, we've treated diseases of the brain separately from diseases of the body. And I think if you look at most curricula as it relates to health education in the United States, you will find very little to no training on substance use issues, even though we know it has a dramatic impact on many health conditions that people have. The Government Accountability Office estimated that veterinarians in the United States get more pain training than physicians in the United States. So part of our goal is mandatory prescriber education. I think we have 11 states now that have mandatory prescriber education. Prescription drug monitoring programs, I'll talk a little bit about those, but these are databases that identify as people's use becomes more chronic. They often go to multiple physicians and multiple pharmacies for their prescriptions. And these databases provide prescribers an opportunity to identify who those folks are and hopefully do an intervention and get them into care and treatment. We know that about 70% of people who start using medications misusing prescription pain medications for the first time, get them free from friends and family. And I often talk about this as an epidemic of the medicine cabinet. So part of our efforts are really about how do we get and dispose of unused and unwanted medications from people's homes. So go home, check your medicine cabinets. Don't save your drugs for a rainy day, because we know that that's where they get diverted. And enforcement opportunities. How do we close down some of these pill mills that we had operating in the United States? So again, 11 states have mandatory prescriber education, and we're beginning to see success with these programs. So Florida, the middle one, and I'll just talk about that, because Broward County in Florida, I think, had 50 of the top 100 prescribers in the United States because of lax legislation, lax oversight. And through a series of actions, Florida was actually able to see a 50% decrease in overdose deaths from oxycodone as a result of the actions that they were able to take. And again, Tennessee and New York saw significant reductions in doctor shopping behavior through the use of these state databases. We've also been working on safe disposal regulations. So we now actually have a regulation that allows for continuous drug disposal at the community level. So, which is good. So you don't have to wait for these DEA-sponsored drug take-back days. And we want to get people in the habit of routinely getting rid of those medications. And some interesting models around the country where King County in Washington and Alameda County in California actually, through product stewardship laws, got the pharmaceutical companies to pay for the disposal programs that they had. We've all seen the issues around heroin and injection drug use and the medical consequences that we've seen. While only a very small portion of people actually transitioned to heroin, just about all of the newer users to heroin started misusing pain medication. And we've all seen the dramatic increase in overdose deaths. So we've been focusing on overdose education, particularly for those who are high risk, as well as naloxone distribution. And if you don't know, I'm sure you've all heard, naloxone has been used by first responders for a long time. And we have really been supporting more widespread naloxone distribution by anyone who's in a position to experience an overdose. And again, we've seen law enforcement across the country take on naloxone distribution in ways that I would never have thought that they would. And I think it's really been amazing to see. Just earlier this week, the FDA approved the first nasal product for use in an overdose. And this is great. The only other product was an auto injector, kind of like an EpiPen, but it cost a couple hundred dollars. So this is the first nasal administration. And I think through a collaboration with Clinton Foundation, they're offering folks a discounted price of $75 for two doses. So we're hoping that this will really take hold. Earlier treatment as prevention, we miss opportunities to intervene in people's addiction in many places, and it's often why people progress to heroin use. I think you have seen the dramatic increase in hepatitis C among people who inject drugs. All of you are probably familiar this summer with Scott County in Indiana. I think it's about 9,000 people in rural Indiana. They identified 185 new cases of HIV linked to sharing needles for people who were injecting prescription pain medication. And we'll talk a little bit about syringe access programs and maybe how you guys can help us with syringe access program. If there's any bright spot on the horizon, we have three FDA-approved medications that are proven to be the standard of care for people with opioid use disorders. And I think for those of you who know this field, there has been a lot of misunderstanding around medication-assisted treatment. So I won't tell you who, but I was just having a spirited discussion with one of our members of Congress about Suboxone. And he's like, well, this is just replacing one addiction for another, and people need to get off these medications. And, you know, tried to engage him in a discussion, but this is a good example where science and data don't often drive public policy. So, you know, this is kind of policy by anecdote as opposed to policy by science. So part of our work on the federal level is to really focus on expanding access to medication-assisted treatment. Secretary Burwell announced this summer $100 million for community health centers to support expansion of MAT and to really focus on holistic health, because we know that many people have comorbid medical conditions as well as psychiatric conditions. So we've been focusing on that. We've been working on public education campaigns. So one of the commitments that we were able to get at a recent announcement with the president was the Fraternal Order of Police are going to distribute overdose prevention cards to all of their members so that every police officer can identify the signs and symptoms of an overdose and hopefully revive them. Naloxone expansion, we continue to focus on that and increased education. We held a town hall in West Virginia where the president spoke quite movingly about the opioid epidemic and really talked about the fact that we need to focus more time and energy around treatment expansion and to really hear from some pretty compelling people in terms of the work that they were doing. I also think it's remarkable, and I'm sure many of you have seen, that we have just about every presidential candidate talking about these issues. For those of us who've been in the field for a long time, where politicians did not want to talk about this issue, we have an incredible opportunity, I think, before us with both our president and presidential candidates talking about this issue. This is an incredibly bipartisan issue in Congress right now. And I think that, again, we have a real opportunity to make some significant change with the work that we're doing. So as part of this, the president issued a memorandum to really reduce prescription pain medication and heroin overdose deaths to promote effective prescribing. So part of what we are doing now is if you work for a federal agency and you are a prescriber, you have to take mandatory prescriber education. So we're trying to model what we want the rest of the field to do. But we also know that insurance plays a key role in ensuring that people have access to all the FDA-approved medications. So we also issued a memorandum that asked all of our federally sponsored insurance programs, Medicaid, Medicare, VA, DOD, Federal Employee Health Benefits, to identify any barriers to providing all of the FDA medications for opioid use disorders and to implement an action plan to correct that. So that's, I think, really important. So this is why we do what we do. So Taylor Smith, 20 years old, died from an overdose. For me, she becomes kind of the compelling case of why we need to deal with this issue in a very, very urgent way. So what are some of the underlying issues? Why have we seen this opioid epidemic take such a strong foothold? I always like using this chart. This is from the National Survey on Drug Use and Health that shows the estimated 22 plus million people in the United States who meet diagnostic criteria for a substance use disorder. Only about 12% ever get care. So we don't know how many people recovered on their own, went to 12-step meetings. But again, when you look at kind of the condition that we have, and by comparison, diabetes has roughly about the same prevalence rate as substance use disorders. And the treatment rate for diabetes is about 80 to 85%. So that's a good thing. And you think about why. One, we do a pretty good job around prevention. We do a really good job around early intervention and identifying people, telling them when they're at risk, monitoring them along the way, doing a good job at getting people into treatment. We also do a really good job, because it's a chronic disease, of doing continuous care management for that population. Yet we don't do that with substance use disorders. And I will also say, I hate the way that this question's framed. Did not feel that they needed treatment. So tell me what other disease where we expect people to self-diagnose. Right? No, seriously. So, you know, we don't wait till people say, geez, I think I have diabetes and I go get care. But that's what we do for addiction. And it drives me nuts when we use things like hitting bottom, right? So again, in what other disease do we say you have to get to your most acute phase where we motivate you or intervene to get care? We don't do it. So part of our work is to really reframe what we're trying to do. And so the implications of that, I think, are really interesting. So these are referral to treatment sources in 2012. By and large, someone has to self-identify that they have a problem, go get care, or they're waiting to an intersection with the criminal justice system before we're doing intervention. So look at other healthcare providers, 7.2%. So only 7.2% of referrals are coming from our healthcare system. I always say, if you pull out your insurance card, it'll probably have two numbers on it. One will be your primary care provider. And the other number will be your behavioral health provider. You know, we basically have kind of bifurcated these issues and don't do a really good job of understanding the health implications around addiction. So I always use this as an example of what we should be shooting for. So if those of you work in the HIV world, this is the HIV continuum of care. And what it shows is a percentage of people who know their HIV diagnosis, who've been given a diagnosis, first of all, and then linked to care, engaged in care, and get to viral suppression, because that's our ultimate goal with people who have HIV. And this is a very interesting template for thinking about how we deal with issues of addiction. So again, we don't even know of kind of our 23 million, 22.4 million, how many people even ever got a diagnosis. We know that only a small percentage are getting linked to care. We don't know how many people are actually getting to long-term recovery. So our goal of viral suppression is long-term recovery. Tom McClellan and Bob DuPont are long pioneers, actually just published a paper that's saying the measurement of success for addiction treatment and recovery should be 5 years, right? So like we do with other diseases, particularly cancer, right? You reach the 5-year point, pretty good likelihood that you're going to be in remission for the rest of your life. Yet the only way that we measure treatment is how many people access care, right? So not even how many got to long-term recovery. And part of the reason is for even those people who are getting care, we are largely using an acute care model to deal with a chronic disease. So again, if you're fortunate enough to have come to the realization that you have a problem and you're lucky enough to get in care, you receive treatment and you're discharged. You know, it kills me when our treatment programs used to say things like graduation, like you've graduated from the program. And again, you know, the measure of success has largely been how many people get into care versus how do we think about this as a chronic care model? How do we implement prevention programs? Do a better job at early intervention, particularly for people who are at risk, making sure that people have a wide variety of access to treatment and also looking at ongoing recovery support models. And many of this is really tied to our historic reimbursement rates for treatment. But I think we're beginning to change that. One of the things that we've been working on, and quite honestly, this has been funded by a wide variety of grant makers, is really looking at screening and brief interventions. Again, how do we move away from letting people hit bottom and do a better job of integrating screening throughout our healthcare systems and do a better job at intervening earlier in someone's disease progression? I'll tell you just a quick story. I switched healthcare providers when I was in Massachusetts. And as I was waiting for the physician to come in for my intake appointment, I noticed that on his bulletin board, he had one of the validated screening tools for substance use disorders. I thought, great, I picked the right doc. And he comes in, I'm like, doc, it's great that you have that. And he said, you know, I don't use that because people don't tell the truth. And I was like, no, so close. But again, this is some of the cultural stuff that we've got to get over in our medical profession around doing that. One of the things that we talked about, and actually June Savilli, who runs our treatment branch right here, we had a great meeting at the White House with the Board of Addiction Medicine and many of our federal partners and many of our specialty medical societies with the whole goal of how do we increase the education within medicine and increase the practice of some of these things like ESPRT to do some of the work that we do. And I still track pretty closely some kind of what happens in Massachusetts, where Governor Baker, as part of his plan, actually convened all of the medical deans in Massachusetts to get their support on increasing their training around addiction. I think the other piece, and then I'll wrap up and we can talk about the Affordable Care Act, I think really provides us, and the implementation of parity provides us a really great opportunity to think about tremendous system redesign and integrated care. So really moving away from this fee-for-service-based system to a coordinated care model where we're paying people not for the service that they provide, but for good outcomes. And hopefully we can kind of move away from this illness-based reimbursement system and think about kind of preventive care services for folks. So if you only get a certain amount of money to care for a person's care, you're going to do everything that you can to avoid costs. And a lot of that is keeping people away from emergency departments and high-end detoxification services and moving toward more outcome-based services and really focusing on things like integrated medical and behavioral health services. So a number of states, including Rhode Island, is doing a medical home model in their opioid treatment programs to give people holistic and integrated care, and the development of accountable care organizations that are really responsible for all of the medical and behavioral health outcomes of people in their work. I talked about medications. I'll just say this, because I think this is an opportunity. I think you all know that the way we think about people has a dramatic effect on public policy. And so for many, many years, we thought that people with addiction are bad people. And our response was largely punitive. While we've made some progress, we still know that for both people with mental health and substance use disorders, that stigma prevents people from seeking care, delays people from seeking care, and has a dramatic shape on public policy. And so part of what we continually want to focus on is how do we support this recovery movement in the United States? Because I think it's really important, as we've seen with other stigmatized populations, that if you provide a level of visibility around those, that people's perceptions change. And I use the expression, it's hard to hate up close. And I think the explosion of this recovery movement that we have in the United States happening, particularly among our young people, really has the potential to change how we do that. And one of the easy ways that we can do that is changing our language. Someone who I know who's a researcher at Massachusetts General Hospital did this really interesting study where he gave trained clinicians nearly identical scenarios of a person. And the only thing he changed was in one scenario, described the person as a substance abuser, and in the other scenario, as a person with a substance abuse disorder. And even among trained clinicians, if you refer to someone as a substance abuser, it elicited a much more punitive response, even among trained clinicians. You know, I hear this language all the time. You know, I got clean and sober in a 12-step program, and I know that sometimes we can ourselves perpetuate some of this language when we talk about things like addict or junkie or drunk, that we know that we continue to perpetuate some of the stigma that's associated with this. And I do think that we have an exciting opportunity, and we really are at the tipping point here of really changing people's perception about that. So clearly, really understanding the impact of the Affordable Care Act and the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act become really, really important. The stigma reduction. So to what extent can we reduce stigma and really look at that as an opportunity? Clearly, prevention and early intervention services, how do we work with our medical communities to do that? I'll talk about law enforcement diversion. We hear from law enforcement all the time saying, what are the models out there? How do we think? And again, I think Ford Foundation has been funding the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Program, beginning to show some promising results on how police can divert people away from the criminal justice system. So we're seeing the development of these models to do that. Integrated care models in the behavioral health world in general, but particularly around addiction, we don't have a lot of really good kind of evidence-based and evaluated models for how do we integrate care. Recovery research is an area of interesting possibilities about what are those structural interventions, policy interventions, clinical practice that get people and keep people to long-term recovery, because I think that that is really important. So we know that people beyond just treatment need things like housing, employment. They need a network of peers to help support them. But I think we need to continue to think about kind of those policies and practice that really kind of keep people and get people to long-term recovery. So just let me end by saying, I think having been doing this work for longer than I care to admit, and again, born, I think, out of extreme tragedy of the overdoses, things coming together in ways that provide us tremendous opportunities and an acknowledgement of the role that substance use plays in our communities. And so in addition to criminal justice reform, we have this vibrant advocacy movement happening. It's become a political movement where we've have at the state level and at the national level a lot of attention on these issues. So I'm really thrilled to think about ways that we partner with foundations. There will always be things that you guys can do that we can't do, and particularly around some of the edgier areas of exploration. So I just want to thank you for your attention to this issue, and happy to kind of have a conversation from here on in. Thanks.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. For more information about Grantmakers in Health, visit us online at gih.org.